All right, y'all, welcome back. It's Anti-War Radio. Our next guest is Franklin Lam. He is a lawyer and a former board member of the Sabra Shatila Foundation, director of Americans Concerned for Middle East Peace, and former professor of international law at Northwestern College of Law in Oregon. He's got this great piece at Counterpunch called The Lutfala II Arms Smuggling Scandal. Welcome to the show. Franklin, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
And you're in Tripoli, Lebanon right now?
No, Beirut.
Oh, in Beirut. Lebanon. Okay, well then hi to the NSA guys on the line too. Good to talk to y'all again. Alright, so the Lutfala II, that's a boat that was full of guns. Tell us everything.
Well, it sailed on last Thursday after being loaded in Benghazi, Benghazi, Libya. It's owned by some Syrian businessmen who are based in Saudi Arabia. What eyewitnesses have said, including Hassan Anan, who was in Benghazi, and others, the boat was loaded with two large containers containing totally 150,000 tons. It was meant to take 2 million tons. It was the manifest shows that there were going to be 15 containers. And what happened then is that it left Libya, went to Egypt, went to Turkey, and back, and then headed for Tripoli, Lebanon. And it was someone tipped them off, and the Lebanese Army Marines boarded it and found these weapons. Now it's in Libya port. There have been 21 arrests today, and people are trying to get to the bottom of who was responsible for these weapons. The government here and most of the eyewitnesses who have spoken indicate that that craft was to leave, that vessel was to leave Tripoli, Libya, and go over to Latakia in Syria.
Mm-hmm. It was headed to the rebels in Syria.
Well, that's certainly the presumption, because now, as you know, just a little background, during the war in Libya, the NATO war in Libya, mm-hmm. I was there for 4.5 months, and I'm part of an international team that's wanting to bring and working on bringing a case before the International Criminal Court against NATO. So we have done a lot of research, as you know, the New York Times did some, and also the Human Rights Watch and some other groups, showing the civilian damage and the violations of the laws of war and international humanitarian law conducted by NATO between March 18 of 2011 and October 31 of 2011. You know, they flew some 12,000 sorties, mm-hmm. of which close to 8,000 were bombing sorties, and they enabled the regime of Gaddafi to be toppled, because without NATO, of course, the people in the street in Benghazi, you know, probably would have been over the whole incident maybe by late March or mid-April. So it was very much NATO's war. They called the shots, and they, you know, bombed and paved the way for rebels to advance. So it became, for a lot of young men, and not all Libyans, a sort of a lark. I mean, there were plenty of guns, there were money. So now, as you probably know, a big problem of the transitional government is getting those arms out of the hands of all these militia, who number almost 500. I mean, you can imagine, you know, an adolescent life. The government provides almost everything, free education, free medical care. You don't really have to work there to get by. So in a sense, Gaddafi spoiled the people, but give them some guns and anti-aircraft weapons on the back of a Toyota pickup racing around, and it's very addictive. And that's exactly what happened. So the country, in short, was awash in weapons. weapons of stockpiles that Gaddafi's forces had but could not access because of NATO. Some were, not found. And then Qatar shipped in large quantities of arms funded by the Saudi Arabians and the regime in Doha, Qatar. And this is not speculation. I mean, this is a matter of fact. They admit that during the war, as you probably recall, they supported the NATO operation. They got the Gulf Cooperation Council to support it. They got the Arab League to support it. So their involvement is very clear. Real briefly, the war ends October 31. All these weapons all over the country.
Well, actually, hold it right there. I wanted to ask you real quick. The way I remember it was the Americans kind of twisted some arms, probably not too hard, because I guess the Saudis always hated Gaddafi anyway or whatever, but the Saudis kind of played hardball and said, well, you have to help us or at least turn a blind eye to our crushing the opposition in Bahrain in order for us to go along with your war in Libya. And that was the handshake deal that they made. And so in that sense, due to that deal, the Saudis and the Qataris and whoever else were simply acting as NATO sock puppets in that war in Libya. So one, I want you to go ahead and agree or disagree with that, say whatever you want about it, and then two, make the parallel to Libya if there is one. I mean, to Syria now if there is one.
Okay. That could have been. Of course, Gaddafi insulted the royal family 3 years ago, remember? He called for his assassination, and there was evidence that plot had been set in motion. So, yeah, the Saudi Arabians detested him, and vice versa. But, you know, the Americans decided under this RP2, responsibility to protect, with people like Lieberman in the Congress and John McCain and others, that, by God, this is an opportunity to show what we're made of. So there was domestic pressure in the U.S. that was taken to the Security Council. The British jumped in with it. Sarkozy did. The Russians were ambivalent, but finally went along, and that's an important fact, as did China. So they had this resolution 1701, and they launched the campaign. Certainly, the Saudis, once the war started, the fact that they would supply money, because again, they're feeling that Gaddafi was a tyrant, and the Qataris, I guess for a bunch of reasons, joined this campaign. I think a lot of it too was American pressure. Americans didn't want to get in with foots on the ground, but they wanted the Arabs to do the job, and the Qataris did send special forces. So did the Americans. The Americans were training the rebels, trying to whip them into shape. The French also had special forces, and the British, but they were small in number. They relied on the rebels, who would get guns and money, but they relied on those 8,000 bombing runs by NATO to pave the way and to destroy the heavy artillery, the tanks, and any forces of Gaddafi that could be found, you know, at bases and in formation. So that got it, that launched it, and the reason, I mean, it was successful for a bunch of reasons. One, Gaddafi's army had really weakened. Remember, he did the deal in 2003
the nuclear party. He gave up his centrifuges. Right. And this is my whole theory about the Libya war, and I think it's partially confirmed, at least, by Michael Hastings and his piece on Libya, that Hillary said, we got this whole Arab Spring off on the wrong foot, meaning PR-wise. And America needed to take the little guy's side in one of these things, because it was too obvious. We backed every tortured dictatorship in the region. Less Syria and Iran, because we don't control them anymore. I'm sorry, we have to leave it right there and go out to this break, but we'll be right back with Franklin Lamb. He's got this great piece in the Counterpunch there, the Falatu arms smuggling scandal. All right, y'all, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. Talking with Franklin Lamb. former professor of international law at Northwestern College of Law in Oregon, and author of this great piece at Counterpunch, The Lutfala II Arms Smuggling Scandal. I'm afraid we've gotten a little bit off topic here, talking about the parallels with the war in Libya. And, well, I mean, obviously the boat starts in Libya, so that has a lot to do with it. You were making the point that Gaddafi had only come in from the coal back in 2003, and then I was trying to chime in. I said it in the long form, but long story short, he was expendable. He was the most expendable of America's sock puppet dictatorships in the region, and so they went ahead and made an example out of him, really for American televisions, I think.
I think so, too, because remember, going back to 2002, he did the deal on Lockerbie through his son. He started at least then training his police in the U.S. He got rid of his weapons, most of them of the mass destruction, and he was given the seal of approval, in a sense, and he started doing major business deals with American corporations, French and Italians, British. And in a sense, it's a little odd that they went after him. And you mentioned the potential similarity with Syria. We could list 12 reasons why Libya was not similar to Syria: the size of the population, the fact that that Gaddafi didn't really have an organized army. A lot of them stood them down to impress the Americans. His equipment was old, a lot of it not well maintained. The Syria is much stronger, has a, 400 man army, really modern weapons that they've got from everywhere, from, Russia and Iran. The other thing, Gaddafi didn't have friends because of his image and his unreliability. Nobody was willing to go out on a limb. The African Union sort of tried, but he couldn't even get support really much in Africa, where he had earlier, somebody, they declared that he was king of Africa. But in Syria, they've got Iran, as you know. They've got the support of Hezbollah, Hamas, and also Russia and China and Turkey, typically, but right now, not right now. Nobody wants a war, or NATO does not want a war on the ground at all, and the Americans certainly don't, because also the strategic position of Syria that Gaddafi didn't have. Gaddafi had one thing: sweet crude, and we were getting that. Really, a lot of sweetheart deals were done. But I agree with you. They wanted to make an example. Remember when Obama first announced it, because the CIA had been over there a lot. They knew he didn't have any army. And Obama said, look, this is going to take days, not weeks, because the CIA predicted
months and
that.
Months.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
he also, he claimed... Yeah. He claimed, I love this parallel, where Bill Clinton pretended that 100,000 men, women, and children had been killed in Kosovo in order to start his phony war in 1999, like Bush's weapons of mass destruction. In this case, Obama just promised that 100,000 men, women, and children would be killed if he didn't start the war now, where there was no wholesale slaughter of innocents to even point at. Just that, take Gaddafi's statements out of context, and he
Absolutely.
Just promised that he would.
Yeah. Now, Gaddafi made a mistake that a lot of the dictators have in this so-called Islamic Awakening Spring, Arab Spring period, which some people say is over. I maintain it's just beginning. It's going to continue until they liberate.
Well, and same thing for the counter-revolution, and that's really the story. I mean, this thing, I agree, it's going to go on for a long, long time. Tunisia and Egypt are just the very beginning of the thing. It's going to be a whole era, going on here. But
yeah.
But now, we need to learn more here about, we only have, a good 6-7 minutes left, something like that.
Okay.
To learn about the Lutfala II, and, what is probably going on here, it sounds like what's happening is they took a bunch of arms that had been sent to Libya for the war there last year, and they took the excess, they put it on a boat, and supposedly we'd heard some reports, I think, that there were a few hundred, at least, Libyan fighters that had also been sent to Syria, apparently to help the rebels to overthrow Bashar al-Assad.
Early earlier. That's true. And certain Salafists and people say, oh my God, Al-Qaeda was a danger in Libya and Al-Qaeda is now a danger in Syria. But I say that's nonsense. Al-Qaeda will take an opportunity when it gets it, but they're small in number and that's no reason to keep a dictator. The one thing that was similar, so we could go on for half an hour and list the differences between Syria and Libya, as I think you'll agree. But what is fundamental and what is the same was the decision was made before NATO went in that there was going to be regime change. They accomplished that. The decision in Syria, despite all these calls for the Annan, the six-point plan and the dialogue and all this stuff, it's regime change.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans will not stop. They represent the empire. They want to return to hegemony. They've got to get rid of this regime so the next regime will recognize, as they claim, Israel, and that it'll be a big blow to Iran. Also to Russia. Remember, we're in competition increasingly with Russia. They hope that the regime change will bring the end of Hezbollah as well. So that's the crossroads, that's the crosshairs, and that's why it's going to go on. I personally predict that Assad will have to go because the numbers are getting too high with the killing. And there's some major problems there, and there's legitimate concerns from of the people there. I go to Syria a lot. It's right next door. And while I don't like the method that's being used by the Americans for regime change, and I support Iran and Hezbollah and the others who are committed to the resistance, the fact is that kind of regime has got to have got to meet the needs of the people. The question is, can Bashar himself do it, or will he step aside and someone else who can do it?
That's the problem, right, is that the people of Syria, poor them, this has nothing to do with them. This is all about major power politics. There is no Syrian empire with any cards to play. It's all about whose side are you on outside of your own borders.
Absolutely right. So I
well, and now tell me this too, problem. We don't really get much reporting out of Libya anymore. Obviously, what we get doesn't lend to the idea that everything is great and peaceful and prosperity or anything like
problems.
That. But would you expect for once the Assad regime falls, I would predict just outright civil war for years, like the kind of madness that took place in Iraq, right? Massive reordering of power there.
I agree with you. I think that's going to be the model.
They're going to make the current death count look like nothing.
Alawi conflict with foreign interventions of all sorts. The Saudis, the Americans, the Israelis, the Qataris will support the Sunnis. Iran, obviously, will support the Shia.
Yep.
And Iraq will support the Shia. And the Turks, I'm not sure. But, it's years of conflict. Ahead, I'm afraid, in Syria. Meanwhile, in Libya, who knows? I mean, there are now people saying that more people are petitioning for the return of the Gaddafi regime through his son, Saif al-Islam, with whom I met three times last summer. NATO erred. NATO made a huge mistake in Libya, and it's not going to be pretty for years to come either. That's an example, an egregious example of enforced hegemony, attempted hegemony that didn't work out, and it's not going to work out. And Syria, which I say that NATO did not start, but the American administration is badly handling, and they've got themselves into a devil of a mess. Obama won't touch it until after the election. And so, they have time to do what they want the regime. They can do anything they want. There will be no interference. As you know, Russia has made clear, no foreign interference. Except that said, Iran, Hezbollah, and Russia and China are not happy. They're not happy with the killing because their reputation is being damaged. How do you expect that Hezbollah, with its claimed morality, its politics, its resistance, are allowing this slaughter? And I'm a supporter of Hezbollah, but one thing about Hezbollah, you can sit down with them and you can say what you think, and they're open to it. You know, they're very much into dialogue and studying. The Iranians too. So you can express, and I know for a fact that a lot of Hezbollah and the Iranian regime are not happy with what's going on with this incredible embarrassment, the killing. How do they survive in terms of mass support when they're allied with Assad's problem, but yet they supported the uprising in Egypt and Bahrain and the one that's going to come in Saudi Arabia and of course in Tunisia, Morocco and Libya, but what's special about not nearly the numbers were killed that are happening in Syria. So people are asking, even their own people are asking, how do you justify this double standard? And they don't have a good answer.
Yeah.
So I think...
what do you think about the death tolls coming out of Syria? You know, so many times it's the BBC quoting this Syrian Observatory for Human Rights,
yeah,
which sounds to
exactly
me like just the MI6. Is that a real thing? Should we believe anything they say?
I think you average them out. Remember, there were wild claims that Gaddafi killed 150,000 in Libya. I was over there. We knew that was total nonsense. The real figure, of even with the NATO casualties, is something like 7,000. Doesn't matter how many, you know, it's still a crime. I don't know. If you average Amnesty's report, some of the reporters over there and Human Rights Watch and these local NGOs, and nobody can establish much to the contrary, I would put, and the UN itself has given its imprimatur and said it's kind of like 10,000 or 11. I believe personally it's somewhere in that range, because there's a lot of people getting slaughtered. We have here almost a million Syrians. You know, it used to be part of Syria. They're right there. Now, not a million came from fleeing, but scores of tens of thousands came.
I'm sorry. You know what, Franklin? I'm so sorry. We are way over time. I've got
to
let you go and get Ray McGovern on the phone here. Thank you so much
for
your time. I hope we can talk again soon.
Pleasure. Yellow, bye.
Everybody, that's Franklin Lamb. Look at him on his article at Counterpunch here. Another Watergate unfolding, the Lutfala II arms smuggling scandal.